Welcome again to our study of Joshua. I'm your host, Bob Resch. With me are my conversation partners, Dr. Matilda Fry and Dr. Jody Washburn. We are going to read some background and some texts, which I would like to call Living in the Land, Soft Answers. Maybe you'll find that in your quarterly, too. So, we have tribes of Reuben, Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh. Why are they so frequently mentioned together? Perhaps as part of the larger group of tribes or kind of separate? What's the background for that, Dr. Washburn?
I think they're set apart as the ones for whom Moses gave land on the east of the Jordan.
Yes, and why did they have land there? Well, they liked it. They were the firstest with the mostest. They went to Moses and said, "This we like this fine." And he said, "You can have it. But remember, you're going to go across with everybody else and make sure everybody gets their properties too. And your women and kids can stay here with your sheep. That's all right. But you don't get to take this up as your permanent home until you've helped other people get permanent homes." Is that generous or just basic human kindness?
Now, here is another thing that just comes to my mind, because when you get to the west side of the Jordan, the land is quite hilly and mountainous and more rugged. But on the east side of the Jordan, you have more plain fields.
Mm-hmm.
So these three, two and a half tribes, get to have a piece of land that is quite pleasant on this side of the Jordan.
Okay. So these tribes have been fighting with the other Israelites, I mean on the same side as the other Israelites, for, I don't know, maybe 8 or 9 years. And now everybody's happy. They all get to take a breath of relaxation a little bit. And the soldiers of these tribes had willingly joined and even led the other tribes in their conquest west of the Jordan. Now it's time for a rest. So Joshua called the tribes together. He called these particular tribes and said, "You can go home now. You have done just as Moses, the servant of God, commanded you. You've obeyed every order I've given you. You've not deserted the other tribes. You've done your work. You've done well. You were very careful to remember Moses." So Joshua blessed them, sent them away. They went home. And it reminds us that the land that Moses had given them. So they left the rest of Israel at Shiloh in the land of Canaan. They started the journey back to their own land of Gilead. And that was their place. Moses had given it to them. Now, they came to a place they were not quite home yet. They're still on the west side of the Jordan. And it says, "The men of Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh stopped to build a large and imposing altar." What was the point of this story? Now, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob made lots of altars. Why is it special to make an altar here and now?
Well, at the end of the story, we learn that their reason is to build an altar to possibly keep that connection to their brother uh-huh. tribes on this side of the Jordan, and to kind of like set that up as a they call it a testimony or a witness between them and the tribes on the east side of the Jordan. And so they feel that is a good way of like keeping that relationship going, because the Jordan is this body of water that separates. And so to have this bridge in between, and the altar might function like that, at least in the eyes of the three, Reuben and Gad and half Manasseh, it functions like that.
And to remind everybody of why they built this altar.
Yeah.
There was a beautiful bronze plaque saying this altar was built on such and such a date. That's not what happened.
No.
There were some rumors that got out. Dr. Washburn, tell us about those rumors.
Yeah, I find it so interesting. You know, I'm always interested in zooming out and looking at the bigger picture. And here we have like the folks who are going to settle on the west side of the Jordan now are perturbed. They're a little put out because, well, if if our, you know, other tribes that already have their spot on the east side of the Jordan feel the need to build a altar on our side, then maybe they're trying to somehow say they belong here, et cetera. They seem to say, like, this is not the altar, right? You can't have an altar because we have the altar of the Lord our God, and that altar is the only one that's allowed to be in this region. And again, I find a certain level of humor in these texts, because later on, when we have, after the period of Solomon and David, when, you know, there's a peace on every side, right? Then the kingdom, the united monarchy, splits, and two tribes, stay. And then there's a dividing line, right? The other tribes decide, no, we don't want to submit to this slave labor contract that Solomon's son is asking of us. So we are going to live up here. And up there, the kings decide, okay, we are going to create like a high place. Like they've always had a high place. Everywhere they go, they find a place to put an altar and people gather and they worship Yahweh. Well, here they build. And when the people in the south write about that, they say, oh, well, that is not for Yahweh. But the people, to the people in the north, they're simply doing what they've always done in every generation, have an altar where they gather to worship Yahweh. And so here you see this same thing. And I find that, I find a certain amount of, like, I want to chuckle internally when I see this. Because what is the pattern, right? Where we say, oh, what they're doing is too, it's not close enough, but it's too close, right? We have to make sure that we correct them.
Well, let's correct them, shall we? Should two people or two groups of people have exactly the same methods of worship or conceptions of the God they worship? Is it essential that they all be in lockstep in such respects?
Well, what does that even mean? Because you think here the concern seems to be that the altar is not in the place where the altar is now that they've settled in the land. But it wasn't that long ago that they all just carried around their place of worship and it went everywhere with them. And everywhere it went, God was there with them. You know, God was tenting among them. So this question of who has more of the right to say, oh, well, God is with me, but not quite so much with you. I feel like this tension comes up over and over.
So if you, again, connect Joshua with Deuteronomy, in Deuteronomy, you learn about the centralized worship that is supposed to happen in one single place. Mm-hmm. And everybody is supposed to come and gather in that place at least three times per year. Mm-hmm. Now, here might be a story about the concern. What happens if this law from Deuteronomy is not followed correctly? Mm-hmm. And so they have the priest in the name of Phinehas, whom we learn about from the book of Numbers, appears here again. And he is quite like enamored and goes like full steam ahead to kind of like try to figure out, is this a sacrilegious act that is happening
it's
here?
It's assumed to be sacrilegious,
yes.
Act.
Yes.
Now, should we make important decisions for ourselves or for the community based on a rumor we just heard?
We should not, of course.
But it's highly entertaining to respond to rumors and to spread them, isn't it?
We do like that.
So there, rather than a careful investigation of, by the way, why exactly did you do this? How did you determine the pattern? What does this mean to you? What do the majority tribes decide they should do about this question? Which is a legitimate question, is what's the purpose of this altar?
They will gather and go to war.
Why would they think of war as the number one option?
It's been their constant companion, so to speak, for a while.
So it seems in Joshua, the war always happened against other people groups.
Uh-huh.
And now they turn against each other.
Have you ever heard of that anywhere else in the Bible or in human history? How many fights are based upon misunderstandings? Maybe Jacob and Esau, for example, could have had a huge fight. So there have been many wars, and there probably will be some more. Should a nation start a war, do you think, before or after honest attempts to preserve the peace?
Well, that's what we understand under the term negotiations, and we know how those play out too many times when words fail.
Mm-hmm. The sabers rattle.
Mm-hmm. Killing begins.
And what if even before you start negotiations, you start waving the sabers?
That's what we do when we feel scared, isn't it?
If we have a saber, we probably wave it, yes. Mm-hmm. So we have a delegation not to preserve the peace, but to go to war. And then somebody had the good sense to say, wait a minute, what exactly are we fighting about? Could we ask some questions before we start slaying people? So could I ask, in our day, could the popular news stories that we all hear, could any of those be actually based upon factual error?
Hmm. We live in a time where that question is so pertinent, and we find each other on all kinds of sides on the situations that we encounter.
And Bob, I think you made a really good point earlier when you asked, like, how interesting that the first thing that they feel is available to them as an option for how to respond is war. Well, when you read these narratives, you think, oh, well, of course. And if you think about all of us, you know, we encounter various tidbits of information. And the only thing that we have at our disposal for how to interpret that is what we're familiar with, our experiences, our background, our language, our cultural connections, you know? And so it really does, a story like this really does invite a pause, I think, to say, like, okay, that is the first option that comes to your mind, for perhaps for good reason, but maybe pause and recognize there can be multiple things going on.
So could the responses and the proposed solutions be a bit simplistic? There's a whole genre of American movies based on the idea that no matter how complex the problem means, it can be settled with a hard fist to the right.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what we want to do when there are differences? Should we ask more questions before seeking violent answers? What should we do? Well, the people who had built the altar gave an eloquent reply, and as a result of which, they said this was not to cause a stir, this was not to start a war. We actually intended to keep the peace. Oh, if that's what you mean, sure, that's a great idea. Congratulations, you have rescued Israel from being destroyed by whom? 31, being destroyed by the hand of the Lord. Even if they're going to kill themselves, they're going to blame the Lord for it. Well, we've come to the end of our time again, and I have greatly enjoyed these discussions, and today's too. The time is up. Thanks again to our broadcast technician, Corin Bailey. Thank you, Dr. Matilda Fry and Dr. Jody Washburn. I'm Bob Resch. Hope we can meet again next week for more of The Good Word.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.